What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Left Sets podcast. Today we are going to get to the bottom of the band, the Glorious Sons. We have the whole team here. Let's start at this. This is audio, so everybody's got to describe and you can't see, but let's start at this end of the table.
Nick Attaway, BMG Records, head of promotion.
Okay.
Jason Murray, glorified babysitter slash manager of these young men.
Jay Emmons, assistant babysitter.
Okay, but you're in the band. Yeah. Okay.
Brett Emmons, baby.
Okay, you're the lead singer. Okay, you played last night at the El Rey. What was going on there? Why was everybody there?
I don't know.
Okay, you're a band from Canada. My research says you're not getting any terrestrial radio play in Los Angeles. So what was bringing people to the show?
I would say the live show. We played in L.A. how many times now?
Three?
Yeah.
Where'd you play before the El Rey, if you remember?
The Roxy.
Roxy, Troubadour.
Yeah. What was that?
It was one Troubadour, then the Roxy.
What was the club with the Struts?
We did Wiltern.
You played the Wiltern before you played the El Rey. Well, it's a Live Nation building, I guess that's why. Are you now, you opened for the Stones, right?
Yeah.
How many gigs did you do with the Stones?
Two.
Okay, because the guys who, the promoters of the Stones, were there last night and say, hey, you know, from AEG that you're one of their acts. Okay, so you found there was an increase in audience each time you played in LA?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. We haven't come here and played on our own backs in 3 years.
No.
So this is kind of like a, I couldn't tell you that there's a, I wouldn't know, you know, what the increase would be, because usually we come here and open for other bands.
But who have you opened for?
The Struts. Welshly Arms.
We headlined the Roxy last time we were here.
Well, shows you how much I know.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. You're from Canada. How does the band begin?
I actually had moved out to Halifax to start the band with Brett.
Whoa. A lot of people are Americans. They know nothing about anywhere other than America. Where was you born, as Cheech and Chong said?
Kingston, Ontario.
Kingston, Ontario. For those who are ignorant, how far from Toronto?
2 hours.
Okay. And you grow up in that environment. What's Kingston like for someone who's never lived there?
Small town, quaint little college town.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
Accountant, welder, self-employed.
And how many kids in the family?
Three.
Okay, and you're where in the hierarchy?
I'm the oldest. We have a middle brother, Dustin, and then there's Brett.
The youngest.
Okay, so you grow up in a house. Your father's an accountant. Is he playing a lot of music?
He's a welder, actually. But no, nobody in our family was musical before us.
Okay, I thought he, did I get it wrong about being
my
an
mother's
accountant?
An accountant.
Your mother's an accountant. Sorry about that. Okay, you two guys are in the band. The middle person, boy or a girl?
Boy.
And what is he up to?
He's a contractor.
Okay. So, you're in Kingston. Are you addicted to the radio?
No.
No.
I used to work construction. I hated the radio. They play the same
songs. Okay, we can look it up on the internet. How old are you?
I'm 34.
Okay, so you hear that voice. In the band, you do what?
Play guitar.
Play guitar. And?
27.
You're 27. Okay, so then were you big music fans?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So how'd you get into music?
Dad and mom. Beach Boys and John Cougar Mellencamp. When we were really young, we just put the cassette in and Help Me Rhonda was like, you know, a hit going long road trips. And then I developed my own taste eventually, but that's where it all started.
They had this gigantic, like, I don't even know what to call it, like cassette holder. Yeah, suitcase of cassettes.
Okay, so there was a lot of music in the home.
Well, there was music there, but it wasn't like we were a music family. It was like you get in the car and you put a cassette on. Like,
okay, well, if you were home, you were not on a road trip, would there be music playing?
No. Because of Jay. I would listen to music because of Jay, but not because of my parents.
Okay, so your parents would not be playing music. So, were you? How did you find out about new music?
Good question. You know, same way everybody else does. You just
You're younger than a lot of people. The old days, baby boomers found out about it on the radio, Gen X, MTV.
It's all about what your friends are doing. It's like, you know, your friends listening to Green Day, learning When I Come Around on the guitar. You're like, oh, that's cool. I want to learn that too. And then it kind of like just snowballs like that.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. When do you pick up an instrument?
I was probably like grade 5, grade 6, so like 10, 11.
And what was the inspiration?
My best friend had a guitar, so I was like, dang, I want one of those too.
And what was your first guitar?
It was a Yamaha Strat ripoff type thing. It really sucked. Like, it had like the floating bridge locking tuning things, and I didn't even know how to use it.
So was it
like,
red?
It was black.
And Johnson had the red one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't even know how to tune the thing, and you literally had to get an Allen key to actually unlock it. And like, it was a whole thing. Like,
okay, who paid for it?
Probably mom and dad.
Okay, did you have an amp?
Yep.
What was the amp?
Oh, it was a massive PV keyboard amp that would like blow the roof off the house on one. It was like, it's like, I don't know who would sell a 11-year-old kid this amp. I have no idea. It's like. Like looking back on it, you're like, guy sold it to us for $500, and it's like, it's not even a guitar amp, first of all, and it's the loudest thing I've ever heard.
And you bought this stuff new or used?
Used.
Just from some guy you found on?
From my guitar teacher. He's a bit of a shyster.
Okay. So, did you start guitar lessons before you had this equipment? What actually happened?
Tell the story about your guitar teacher.
So, like the first... Like literally 3 years of my guitar lessons was learning whatever you call notes. Like,
yeah, the Mel Bay books.
Yeah. But it was like Jesus Loves Me and like Jingle Bells. And I'm going to guitar lessons and I'm like.
For 3 years?
Yeah.
Literally. Like, you didn't think of getting another teacher?
Nobody knew.
I'm a kid.
We didn't know.
I just looked at my buddies and like they're going on the internet and getting tablature and playing like cool songs, and I'm playing Jesus Loves Me. I'm like, Jesus, like there's a massive disconnect here.
He's a quiet dude too, so he's not gonna say anything to anybody. He's not gonna tell mom.
I guess I'm persistent to a fault because I stuck with it.
Well, can you read music to this day?
Hell no.
Okay, before he sold you this loud amplifier and the ripoff guitar, what were you playing?
Like music-wise?
No. What did you use for a guitar?
I didn't have one. Like that was the first, that was the beginning.
Okay, so he sold you that stuff and then he gave you the lessons.
Yeah.
And for 3 years, you're learning this religious stuff. You're not playing in any bands. You're not learning stuff at home to cassettes or anything.
I'm trying, you know, but like I said, it's if you ever pick up a guitar for the first time, it's not an easy thing to navigate. It wasn't for me anyway.
Everything Jay does is through brute force, so like it never comes fast to him like that. Like,
it's like, would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. So when did it click, or is it still not clicked?
For guitar, it's starting to click. You know, I think it started to click when I I used to sing. So I would just lean on my buddy who could do like all the November Rain solos. You know, he played guitar. I would just strum the chords and sing. And we had a band, but it was more like us having a drinking competition on stage. And then I went and saw Brett's first band. And I was like, Jesus Christ. I was like, that's a singer right there.
Okay. But a little bit slower. So how long after the 3 years do you start a band and hit the stage or what?
We had really shitty bands for years. So like I was always about starting things, but they sucked, you know.
Did you ever get paid for being in these bands or you just played in the garage?
Oh, yeah. We would get free booze, sometimes $500.
Okay. And what were you up to?
Well, I was like 7 years old. I was at their concerts thinking they were the greatest bands of all time. Okay. I remember like being truly hurt when somebody didn't like their band. I remember them playing in Kingston. There's this place called Confederation Basin, and it's just like, you know, a park, you know, meant for like, you know, events and stuff, and they put on shows there. And I remember this, you know, this guy that was in a band playing before them, this with, you know, space earrings, this punk, you know,
right,
thought he knew everything, was like just chirping my brother's band like heavily. And I was like 9 years old, and I took him to task.
Really?
I hated him. In my whole life, like I would meet people that, you know, Jay was playing rock and roll, okay, at an age when it wasn't cool to play rock
and roll.
Still
not cool, but keep going.
Yeah, okay. But you got all these guys, you know, playing, you know, and I have nothing against their music taste or what they're playing, but there was a certain thing in our town, at least, that the punks always, they always had this arrogance about them that everybody else sucked.
And so you're separating the punks from rock and roll.
Yeah, and which isn't a real thing, but
well, no, it is a thing if you get that deep. Absolutely, I just want to make sure we get it straight.
But in Kingston, Ontario, my brother would be playing these shows, and he'd be playing with punk bands, and he'd be playing rock and roll, and they would always chirp him, and I was like a 12-year-old kid, and I would always chirp them back, and I was there at every show. They were my favorite band on earth. I didn't know how shitty they were. Jay tells me they were shitty, but I when I was young.
You were the younger brother. So how did you get into it?
Him.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did you become a singer?
This is a funny story. I got asked to join a band and be the singer of the band because they knew I was a psycho. So I.
And you were how old?
14.
Okay. And had you sung like in school?
No.
The records, nothing?
No.
So they just, based on your identity, say you'd be a good front man.
Yeah. And I joined the band and we had like 3 practices. And then they stopped calling me. Like, and I was just kind of like, what's going on here? And then I found out like 3-4 weeks later that they'd invited another person to join the band. And I just kind of, you know, I was maybe, you know, one of the first, I don't want to say failures, but, you know, I felt very rejected.
As you should.
Yeah. And I was playing basketball with my friend Richard Storms. And he was like, yeah, I play the guitar. And I was like, all right, well, let's start a fucking band and beat these guys. So we went to his garage and he started playing like guitar, like Slash. Like at least what I would perceive.
Right, right. Your jaw was dropping.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I better learn to sing. So I took the guitar and played Wheat Kings by a band called The Tragically Hip from Kingston.
Of course.
And I literally locked myself in my room for 5-6 hours a night and sang that song, just that song, until it sounded good to myself. And after that, we wrote a song called Rags. And I never looked back. I wanted to do that for the rest of my life. It took over everything.
Okay. Were you any good in school?
I was good at English, at literature, but I was.
So you were not like, you know, a truant guy who's the problem in the classroom or anything?
I was a little bit of a, I was more of a joker. I wouldn't say that I was a problem. I wasn't a troubled youth by any means, but like my teachers would get very annoyed with me. Unless it was English class, because I actually liked English class, so I listened. But
okay. And at this late date, are you like a big reader or something?
We are, yeah, me and Jay read quite a bit. Jay reads more than I do.
What do you read?
Oh, Jesus. You name it. Like I started at least becoming a real reader on Hemingway. I really loved Hemingway. And then, I mean, some of my favorite books are like Confederacy of Dunces, just fiction novels.
Okay, so you start this band, and what do your parents say when they see you want to be a rock and roller?
Well, Jay started the band, and I joined, but I quit university literature, and I called my dad, and I told him I was going to be a musician. And my mom didn't talk to me for a couple weeks, maybe more after that, because, you know, I just went online and canceled all my courses, and I didn't want to give them a chance to talk me out of it.
Right.
But I quit everything, and my dad said, well, you better get a job. So I started working at Call It Spring. It was a stock boy in the back.
Shoe store.
Yeah, a women's shoe store. And played a bunch of terrible gigs for $0 until I joined the Glorious Sons. And then we started making, you know, the big bucks.
Oh, okay. Just to be clear, the band with your friend, did you play in high school?
Yeah.
Did you play any gigs? Do you ever get paid?
Tons. Yeah, well, we played as much as possible, like as much as a high school band. Like, we played as much as we possibly could. We had a fake manager that didn't do anything. I mean, right. We thought we were going to be the biggest band in the world. So, I mean, any opportunity that came our way, we played. And that's the way that it goes when you're starting. You know, like, you just want to play your music.
Okay, so how long did you go to university?
A year and a half.
Okay. At what point did you start this band? Were you playing original material or as opposed to covers?
As soon as I started playing in a band, all I wanted to do was play original material.
But usually when you play original material, audiences are not interested.
Yeah. But I'm a good front man.
As you are, since I saw you. Okay, Jay, while he's going through these mental machinations, what are you doing?
When he's at school, you mean?
Yeah. Did you go to university?
Yep.
And how long did you go for?
4 years.
So you graduated. Yep. And so you were not going to make music your career at that point?
Well, I had a band almost always. Like, I always had something cooking in the background. I literally had no idea what I wanted to do.
But you always talked that you actually did. That's not true. You always wanted to be in a band.
Yeah.
Well, like, I mean, your whole life. I can remember you working and snapping and freaking out about, like, this is not what I want to do. Yeah,
like, when something clicked in my head when I was like 28 years old or whenever I started this, I was like,
so today you're how old?
34.
Okay.
And I was like, this is my last shot to actually do something. So that's why.
Okay, a little bit slower. So you were kind of like a semi-pro musician. And
not even close.
Really? You graduate from college and you do what for like the next 6 years?
Contractor, construction. But we still had a band then, like just playing around Kingston.
And you saw his band and thought what?
I was like, these high school kids blow us out of the water. Like, not a question. It's like you put us back to back. It's like, you know. Yeah, that. And so I saw his band, and then my band kind of broke up and fell apart. Brett and I started, like, writing together. We did, like, an acoustic project, and then...
The Stone Ponies. Don't forget the Stone Ponies.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about that.
It was the bass player from my band, Jay's roommate and oldest friend, Scott, on the drums, Jay on guitars, and me playing acoustic and singing.
Okay, and what happened with that band?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Okay, so how many years after you dropped out of university was it before it became you hooked up with your brother and it was the Glorious Sons?
I dropped out of university to join the Glorious Sons and be in my brother's band.
Okay. Was it the Glorious Sons in name before Brett joined?
It was Pete Rose and the Gamblers.
That's pretty good, especially since right now Pete Rose is, you know, saying he's straightened out, he should be in the band, be in the Hall of Fame. Okay.
I think he should too.
Okay, so it's Pete Rose of the Gamblers. How does it become the Glorious Sons?
Packer.
Yeah.
Packer,
Adam named the band our drummer.
Yeah, he was just like, what about the Glorious Sons? And we were all like, well, it's better than Pete Rose and the Gamblers.
The only thing, you know, when you talk about rock, which is its own sideshow today, of course people would say there's the Rival Sons.
No, I totally agree with you. I wish we were never, ever named the Glorious Sons. I hate the name. If we were named something else, I think we might have more success. I honestly think that we would be less looked at as like, you know, bro rock and roll band. I think if we had, you know, a name with meaning at least, it would help.
Okay. But when he said you were going to become the Glorious Sons, were you aware of the band, the Rival Sons?
No.
No.
Not at all. Okay. So suddenly it's the Glorious Sons. When you get together, the two brothers, how many of the people in the band are still in the band today?
Everybody except our original guitar player.
What happened to him?
He didn't like the road.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you start the band, you're 28 and Brett, you are?
20.
He was young.
20, 19.
Okay. And
19.
Okay. What are you thinking then?
I'm thinking that we're going to be the greatest rock and roll band on earth.
So you're delusional, but okay. What are you thinking?
He was delusional, too. Yeah. You have to be delusional.
But you have to be delusional, but a lot of people are not delusional from the get-go, and you've been woodshedding a little bit. Jay, what are you thinking?
I would rather go home and paint houses than not strive to be the greatest rock and roll band on earth. As soon as you don't want to wake up and be the best, then just fucking go home.
Okay, so now you have the model because it's tragically hipper from Kingston. But once you form the Glorious Sons, what is the next step?
Well, Brett, literally, he wasn't even the singer. He was the tambourine player at first. He would just jump up and, but we'd play.
Well, who was the singer?
Andrew. I sang and Andrew sang.
Yeah. Okay.
And, but we noticed that Brett playing the tambourine was much more engaging than anything else on stage. So we started giving him more tasks. So then he played piano and then he started singing and then we started writing and then, you know.
Yeah. How long did that whole process take?
A year. A couple months. Like,
not a year.
By the time we put out our first record, our producer was like, this guy needs to be singing all the songs.
Okay, but a little bit slower. You now have the band. They're now called the Glorious Sons. Brett starts out on the tambourine. How long before he becomes the singer?
Yeah, probably like full-time singer.
Actually,
like,
2 years. Two or 3 years.
Okay, in that 2 years, when do you make the first record?
Throughout the whole time we were writing the songs.
Like recorded or
recorded? Recorded.
Probably a year and a half.
Okay, in that year and a half, are you playing live?
Yep. Constantly.
Yeah.
Where?
4 times a week in Kingston, Ontario.
I mean, can you make any money playing 4 times a week
in Kingston? No, we didn't make any money.
Like we made enough barely to cover the bar tab. I remember being like getting paid, giving it all back to the bartender and him being like, give me your credit card too because you got to pay for these assholes who just drank $200.
Okay. And then how many of the songs did you play were originals?
All of them.
Yeah. So when we started this band, that was the thing. We're playing our own music right from the get-go. That was the...
There was too many, like, growing up in a small town, a lot of the live entertainment is cover bands, right? Because, you know, they know they'll get paid and, you know, they can make a better living and it's more of a hobbyist kind of mentality. But, you know, we kind of didn't want to do that. We wanted to be ourselves.
Okay, so you're playing, you know, playing in Kingston for bar money. And what's the next step from there?
Well, then we just started getting any gig we could in like Toronto,
okay,
or Ottawa,
or. Well, who's getting these gigs?
Jay. Yeah, my girlfriend at the time was even like calling places, like, you know, it's like all hands on deck, whatever it takes, kind of mentality.
But you didn't have any agent, you didn't have a manager, nothing. No. Okay, so you start playing Toronto, you play Ottawa, to any acclaim, or you just go and that's it?
No.
Usually when we played, first of all, we like to have fun and party, so our friends would come out. And we didn't suck, so everyone had a good time, and they'd get hammered with us, we'd get hammered with them, and all of a sudden, you know, this thing starts happening like one group of people at a time.
It's a community that kind of builds.
And...
Okay, what came first, the community or the recording?
The community. Community, yeah.
Okay, and so you're living in Canada. I'm somewhat sophisticated with Canada. There's a lot of government money. there's a lot of people playing music, but you know, it's much easier to get a hold of the professionals, not as big a country in terms of music business. Are you trying to get a manager? Are you trying to get an agent?
We literally have no fucking clue what we're doing at this point.
Our producer of our first album, John Angus McDonald from the Trues, he's a guitar player, saw our band and asked us if he could produce a few songs for us. And I was like, sure, what does that mean? I didn't have a clue.
This was like a year and a half into the Glorious songs?
Yeah.
Okay, so he records those songs where?
We did it in Newmarket, which is north of Toronto, about an hour.
Okay, how many songs?
Six.
And then how long until they're released?
I don't remember.
We did it in the winter. I think we released Mama summer.
In the summer?
Yeah.
Okay, so what happened when you released it?
It blew up.
One small little like there's all these like small little radio stations in Canada. So like one small town at a time kept adding the song, and our hometown added it, and we had support from this station, Hits FM. And all of a sudden it took like this huge cyclical thing, and all of a sudden it's on the charts and we're driving around and it's getting played.
Okay, but usually it takes a relationship to get on the radio.
Yeah.
Two of you were doing it yourself, or you had somebody involved with that?
Well, I would say that we had a relationship in our producer, John Angus, who, like, honestly, we would not be anywhere without him, because he was already, like, I don't want to say famous, but a very well-known guitar player in a great Canadian band. And, you know, I think the traction of him producing the song...
Just for my audience, that band was?
The Trues.
Okay.
I think that we probably, you know, had a leg up because he produced our song.
So he, whatever his company was, whatever, he was the one responsible for getting it to radio.
We did have a very low level manager at the time, who
so rude, dude.
That's not rude.
As long as you're not referring to me.
Okay, a garage manager.
So he was like, you know, we paid someone $1,200 to take the song to radio. And
okay, but who was that?
Who was what?
The person that took it to radio? Yeah.
It was RPM.
No, it wasn't RPM, no.
Was it?
Who was? It was Kim. Was it Kim?
Yeah. And she did a great job.
She did a wonderful job.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So now, Song Mama's on the radio. Yeah.
One thing I will say is, I just got to correct you here. He's not a low-level manager. We were the first band he ever managed. So he just...
He's a garage manager.
He was learning how to do it.
I'm not throwing stones. I'm just...
No. I didn't take it as a put down. Most bands usually have somebody they start with, and then they're not that worldly. Occasionally, someone grows into the role. So the record is a hit in many markets.
Yeah.
What happens after that?
We play a show with a band in Canada that had a number one song, who's actually on tour with us right now.
And the band is?
Head of the Herd.
Okay.
They had the number one song in the country, and it did blow up like crazy in Canada. And they asked us to play a show in Toronto at the Drake Hotel.
Right.
And we went and played it. And after that, they asked us to come on tour.
And how many dates were in that tour?
A full Canadian tour, probably 25, 30.
Okay, what about your day jobs?
We quit them.
Immediately?
Yeah.
And there was enough money going on the road?
No. I don't even really know how we stayed afloat.
Merch?
Mama money. We got mama money from the song.
Right.
Yeah.
Merchandise.
You always find a way.
Okay, but you were struggling.
I didn't feel struggling. I didn't feel like I struggled at all. I was living with two guys at that time in like this like house that was completely garbage, but I never felt like I was, you know, having trouble. We had one rule, and that was whoever got paid had to buy the weed and the booze. And we would drink like a 2-4 every night, so we were doing okay.
Okay, the other thing, it is Canada with a strong safety net. Are you taking any money from the government at that point?
No.
Zero.
Okay. Wait a minute. I was getting unemployment.
He's talking about music.
No. I'm talking about unemployment. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I was getting unemployment.
And anything else? Or that you're getting unemployment? Is everybody else in the band getting unemployment?
A few members definitely were.
Probably, yeah.
Like, so you're living on unemployment.
Well, Packer worked at the township.
Right.
In Loyalist Township. And, I mean, that's a really good job. So he had a bunch of money saved. Mamba worked with Jay and was a plumber, and he's always been really good with money. So I don't know, maybe he had some money put away. Jay put all of his money into the band.
Okay, but in Canada, let's assume you, how long were you on unemployment for?
Oh, I don't know. I was off and on for, you know, when I was working with Jay, I couldn't claim unemployment.
Right.
So, and Jay also did odd jobs in between shows and stuff, and he would hire me and Younger, the bandmates, to work with him.
Okay, so you go on the road with the band, you play the 20 dates, where does that leave you?
So I think midway through that tour, we were coming back through Toronto, and
Horseshoe.
Yeah. So I think before the Horseshoe Tavern date, Jason, someone from your office called us.
Yeah, it was, yes.
Okay, Jason, tell us the story.
Yeah.
So we, Ian at the office brings the EP from said manager who was working with them before. Great,
right.
Kid. Great kid. Brings it. You should listen to this. So we listened to it. And Mama, they say it was a hit, but it wasn't a hit at that point yet. It was just starting. And we were looking at it of, okay, is that all the band is right. Mama. So get the EP. And I think song 5 on the EP is called Shapeless Art. And it is not structured like a pop song. But the second we heard that, there was a voice and a person in there that were telling these stories that we had to learn about. Like, I can't... It was the furthest thing from a single, but it showed depth in a way that I think a rock band, especially coming from Canada, has a tough time doing. So we hear that. You guys are on your way on tour. Stop by the office, have a sit down, and I'll never forget it. You guys walk in. Brett sits across from me, doesn't say one word. I feel like I'm at a job interview with Jay, and with piercing the eyes, and the complexity of the room was different. I can't explain it. And I know it sounds corny, but it's the reality. So we have this conversation about where we go and what we're going to do. And they had this song on the record, White Noise, which we thought could be a great single, but we thought maybe need a little mix, needed some work before we do it in a strategy. And we had this great conversation. That was it. And we leave, and I remember Brett comes back in to use the bathroom. I was like, Ian, how do you think that went? He's like, I think it went pretty good. Brett comes in, he's like, so are we going to do this? And then they get in and I'm like, no, we got to come see your band tonight, because if the band's not great live, we just won't do it. So we go that night, and I remember it's a snowstorm, and we show up, Horseshoe. You guys were supporting Head of the Herd. We show up, we go on. At this point, they are touring in a converted short bus with blacked out windows, and the inside looks like the dungiest bar you've ever been to. And smells like an ashtray. And this is on a Tuesday or Wednesday in Toronto. So we go in, and I was like, well, I hope it's great, but you never know if it's not great. So we go in, we have drinks, their mom and dad, and everybody's in, and Ian and I go to the front of the stage, and they come on, and I was like, this is gonna be horrible. And I'll tell you why.
That's what everybody
said. I'll tell you why.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
So, Brett, as the frontman, has a keyboard not facing the audience, horizontal or vertical to the stage, singing like this, singing
sideways
to the crowd. It was the most bizarre stage setup I've ever seen, with the tambourine at the time. And I was like, oh, this is going to be horrible. So disappointed. And I think you started with Ruby, and the first note of the first song, I looked at Ian and we're like, holy shit. And it gives me the hair standing up on my arms talking about it, because you could see what it could be. And I remember that night, I was like, we can't let them go out on tour without, like, we need to figure out a way to do this before the world sees what we see. And you know what? 9 years later, I still think the world doesn't see what we see, but we... That night, I remember sitting with mom and dad of all the boys, and there was this real sense of community of people that were there that had come in to see them and were drinking copious amounts of tequila. Packer's dad kissed me about four times. But one of the things that resonated with me is they cared, and we talked about the tour and the safety and taking care of their boys. And I feel like that, in that moment, whether we were able to sign them or not, something was going to happen, whether we were involved or not. And then they go out on tour, and I get a phone call. They're driving from Thunder Bay to Winnipeg on that same tour.
Which is a long distance.
It is. And it's and we're talking minus 30 degrees Celsius weather.
No, we were driving from Medicine Hat.
Oh, yeah. Even worse.
Way worse.
Medicine Even worse.
Hat to Saskatoon.
So
7 hours.
Get a call, and this party bus they're traveling on has broken down. And manager doesn't call us. Nobody calls us. And I find out through mom or dad, maybe.
I don't know. We did four tour dates. We were in the middle of nowhere. In the middle of nowhere, the school bus breaks down, and it's not going anywhere. So our other brother on the time was on the road with us doing film and hanging out and just helping out in any way he could. Him and I go 2 hour hitchhike. Rent a 26-foot U-Haul because that's the only thing we could get. Drive back 2 hours, pick the boys up, unload all the sleeping bags and the mattresses from the school bus into the back of a U-Haul, hop in the front seat, two guys in the front seat, five guys in the back.
No windows.
Shut the door, 8-hour drive, complete pitch black. And we did four tour dates like that in the minus 30.
And nobody called. And nobody called for help. And when we found out about it, I was like, they're going to win no matter what they do, because they just continued to work.
We didn't miss the show.
So we got them plane tickets, because I figured that would probably go a long way in this conversation.
It did go a long
way. Yeah. And we flew them in and took care of all the travel pieces.
Thunder Bay to Toronto? Thunder Bay at the end?
Yeah. And then... we started with, we stopped everything that was in motion in terms of what the plan was going to be, and pushed pause and remixed the next single, brought it all out. And that January, it became the first number one, because I don't think Mama
number
was,
two.
It was number two.
Yeah.
And never stopped. And what that sentiment of the work ethic and, not taking anything for granted and not complaining, without a shadow of a doubt, is the driving force behind where the band is today.
Okay, when you find the band, what are you literally doing, Jason?
Ian, who runs the label with me, partners from the beginning, by default, producer to managing his band, started a label, had some success, didn't plan, had to reimagine what that is, but had been managing this Canadian hip-hop act that The year we signed the Glorious Sons went on to sell a million singles in Canada.
Wow. What was the name of that act?
Classified.
Okay.
A white hip-hop act who broke, had his breakout at 38 years old. Put that in perspective.
What a story.
Unbelievable.
One of the best guys you've
met. From a very small town, still to this day, lives in a town of 600 on the east coast of Canada. So that gave us at least something to talk about, and I learned so much through that process, and I love rock and roll. My first record was Hot Rocks. So when you hear something that speaks to you as a fan, and then you can actually apply the skill set that you don't even realize is a skill set, it's like arts and craft day every day. And you continue. So we were doing that. We really didn't have any money when we signed the band, and we probably begged Board and Steel to get the radio campaign up and the remix and make a video. And I think the bar tab and the damages from that video was a substantial enough line item that I almost choked on my coffee when I got it.
That was a fun video.
Yeah. But we set it in motion. And so all those pieces leading up to that day, I really prepared us when we found somebody that worked as hard as we did.
Okay, so how old were you at that point?
34.
Okay. And you'd been in the music business, scrambling.
I didn't even know this story about you, Brett, but very similar. I dropped out of university, making records throughout high school for beer money. In Canada, there wasn't an infrastructure where there was a direct path to working in the music business. So I'd record my band in high school.
So you had your own band?
Yeah, horrible. But we would press cassettes, and I would pay the guy in the cafeteria to play it, then I'd go sell the cassettes. Didn't think it was a business, and it was just what we loved, and we'd play on the weekends, we'd do all that sort of stuff, and come end of high school, it's like, okay, time to grow up. You go to university because that's what everybody else does. You go to university and kept making records for other people and realizing I'm not the guy who should be in the band. What are you laughing at?
It must have been hard for you.
But I have the same moment where I'm 3 years into university. I'm working at a hospital and kidney dialysis, thinking I'm preparing for MCATs, and dropped out of school. And I came home and told my parents. It was probably like almost 3 months of silence, and the silence got broken. My wife today was dancing with my father at a wedding. He said, I don't care what he does. If he's going to dig a ditch, dig it better to the guy to the right and the guy to the left. And it was this really empowering thing to break free of these chains that really are self-imposed. Because as a parent, you don't really have those. But they're like, what does the music business mean? I'm like, I have no idea. And they're like, well, where are you going to go? I have no idea. And so got a bartending job, and going into the long weekend, I had put an application into a renowned studio outside of Toronto called Metalworks.
Right, Gilmore from Triumph.
Yeah, so, and I was like, well, if I can get in there, I will work harder than anybody else. And so I put an application, they call me on Thursday going into the long weekend. And they're like, we have an intern that's not showing up this weekend. Long weekends are a big thing in Canada. Everybody wants to go. Would you like to come in? We can't tell you what you're going to work on. I'm like, absolutely. I go into my restaurant. I'm there maybe a month. I'm like, if you don't let me do this, I got to quit. He was like, fine, go and do it. First day, first session, Rush, Vapor Trails.
Really? And yes. You're doing what? You're getting tea, et cetera.
Not even. I didn't even know how to wind a cable at that point. And so I'm there as an assistant to an assistant to an assistant, cleaning bathrooms and doing all that sort of stuff. But being that close to magic, it's intoxicating. And so I would do 40 to 50 hours a week there, close the bar, go back and forth, make no money, but you're in the action. You're where it's created. I got to watch Eddie Kramer do Festival Express. We did Chicago. I didn't know what I was doing, but the longer I was there, I realized I didn't want to be an engineer. That's, to me, that felt like accounting work, I guess. It's not where the magic lies, in my opinion. So stayed there for 2 years, outgrew that. In that window, met Ian through his girlfriend at the time, worked at the restaurant with us, and he was in a double-time punk rock band that I thought was amazing. And this is the era of like Fat Records, and I knew nothing about punk rock, like zero. But I was like, holy shit, they're touring. This is great. I'm like, I need to sign this band. I go to rehearsal. The only one that gave me time was Ian. Everybody else didn't trust me. So we go, and I was like, okay, we are going to do your EP. I will find the money to do it. And the first conversation was, well, what do you think about slowing down the drums for a double-time fat punk rock band? It did not help my cause in trying to influence anything in making that record. So I ultimately ended up engineering that record with the band. And I remember we got a lawyer, signed a management deal with them on Thursday, and I was in a 12-passenger van traveling East Coast Canada in the dead of winter with these punk rock kids playing basement shows. And it was eye-opening, and it was exciting. And at the time, I felt like I had won the lottery. And there was zero money. When I mean zero, like, it was a very expensive hobby. But you're in the action. And so you go and you do that and come back, and Ian, still partner to this day, and yin to the yang. We couldn't get a record deal. And I think this is where the management thing really solidified. For better or for worse, I'm a very strong advocate for people I believe in, and I am willing to self-sacrifice in the pursuit of that, for better or for worse. Doesn't always work in my favor, but if that's all that's left behind, I'm happy about that. And so we're out shopping this band that I saw this potential on, that I loved, that the record deals were bullshit and no money. And I knew radio wasn't going to play this band. And I knew the only way they're going to sell records is getting on tour and playing these places. And so Ian and I decided that we were both going to put in $3,000 and start Black Box, which is the record label that we signed the guys to. And we created a culture with every band we signed that, release number one, your job is to recoup so we can make another record. And that was the culture with every band that we signed. So there was a moral obligation to taking care of your own shit to make sure the next artist that came up could have this thing. So that's what started that whole process. But in that moment, the way Brett was talking about his brother, and when people were chirping his brother's band, I think at the core of all of this is that advocacy for things that you love, that the world doesn't necessarily see through your lens, that is so clear to you. And I think that was the birth of what Ian and I do as management.
I can't imagine the shit Jason took for managing our band when we started out.
Okay, so you manage it, but they already have the track Mama is blowing up. You remix the other one.
Yep.
That's blowing up. And is it a continuous?
No. Absolutely.
It's hard to remember those details.
I can totally do, because I wear those scars. I think, so the thing with Mama at arm's reach feels very one-dimensional. And you're coming from a city that people say there's something in the water, whether it's headstones, whether it's the hip. There's something there. And you're trying to carve your own path on the merit of this band, this songwriter specifically. The dynamic of these two gentlemen, but more importantly, the true art, it's like taking coal and grinding it down, and there's a diamond there, and I feel like I'm the only one who could see it in a way that nobody else could. So now you have to go convince people to see it the way you see it before it's actually there for everybody. And when I say every moment was a fight or uncool band, nothing's going to happen, never going to break it radio, never going to break it alternative radio, never going to sell a ticket. Literally every day that was, and I got so sick and tired of
that. We felt that too.
Yeah, of course.
Like, I felt like we were up against people's perceptions constantly, and I didn't think they knew who we were.
Absolutely. And so we make this video for, and it was more money we'd ever spent on a video.
Which was how much?
$32,000.
That's a lot of money. How much of that money is from the government?
That one, $10,000 was from the government.
Okay. Where'd you get the other $22,000? You'd saved it from line other of credit. Projects?
I'm telling you, the diciness of that period, but I figured...
He never told us that it was dicey during that time.
nor my wife. But...
I got to ask, was your wife the same person your father had the conversation
yes.
with?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
She stood by you.
Yeah, still to this day. Key to the success, to be all the way honest. So we make this video, and I'm like, I want the band to try, I want the world to see the band how we see the band, because it will help me tell the story that I think we need to tell. And I think we did it. But at that time, so we were the label, we weren't the manager at that time.
But so you still have the garage manager.
Yes. But very much advocating as if we are the manager.
Poor guy.
Yeah. And so, but once I realized that it was going to take more than what was happening around it, and if I was going to die on this sword, I thought it was important to be the one driving it. And so in that period, you start to see these things that you're telling people, and then it's not being echoed or... reflected in the same way, and that confusion when you're trying to change people's perception is very difficult to the overall goal. And I think we had a conversation about where we were pushing, how we wanted to push, what was important, and the band made a decision that we should probably step in and help them in a deeper level. And to be all the way honest, nothing changed in terms of how we worked with the band as a record label at that point. Nothing changed.
No.
Like, okay, but obviously you got rid of the garage manager. What did he say?
Well,
there's some details that we can't really talk about. That.
But you know what? It was
okay. Did he get paid when he left? Or is he?
Well, that you go down that. No,
It was pretty quiet.
We're fair.
Yeah, it
we're
wasn't a bad guys. Thing. And to be honest,
and where's he today?
He's managing doing great bands. Stuff. Yeah, he's doing great stuff. The band was. He'll tell you to this day that it just was moving too fast. And you know, we invited him to come be a part of our shop to try to mentor, and because I know how loyal these guys are to a flaw, and I didn't want to be the guy to put a wedge in there. But that didn't work out. And if I was only going to do one thing in my entire career, it was going to break this band. Like there was, it was so clear to me. And so when you're willing to do that, those decisions may seem difficult to everybody else, but they're very easy to... at least to me in that time. So we do that, we, you know, take over the whole operation, piece it together, start touring with more strategy. We go from that into what will be our first number one with the Union.
Contender.
So EP, back it up. So EP to, now we gotta make an album. And so we have this EP. And we've got the song White Noise, peaking at number two, and we're making a record for a band. And it's interesting, when Brett joined his brother's band and during the making of that record, it was still a jump ball of whose band it was. And not just between the two of them, with the other guitar player, where everybody is really polite, passive-aggressive in this band at times. and so it's
now we're just aggressive.
Yeah.
We're
getting rid of the passive stuff. Yeah, now we just get right to it. But it's all these things where everyone's not trying to step on anybody's toes. And so we go into this church, we make this record with John Angus, and finish that record. First single comes out. The band goes out for 60 shows, two support tours, one with Airborne, one with the Trues, that probably cost us $60,000.
At least.
Yeah, so we went out and we did that, and we come back, and the first tour we do on our headline in Canada coming out of that, booked by Ian, direct to venue, no promoter, we sell it out.
Okay, the record's now out. Are you making any money on the record?
No, because they're not making money, so how do we fund the touring?
Right.
So there is no money. But you can start to see real people connecting to something that speaks to them the way it spoke to me. In a way that it was very much underground, even though radio was playing it. Because rock radio historically does not translate to record sales.
Certainly not in the modern era.
No. So, but we were seeing the growth, and people were passionate, and they felt like they would get something every night that maybe the last time. And it was very reckless and not always the greatest, but always the most honest. And so we would go up and do that, and so we sell out this tour. Toronto, we sell 900 tickets in advance at the Opera House. Remember, no promoter.
Right.
Ian and I paid for the promotion of that tour, like $500 a market, $1,000 a market. He did the whole routing. He did the advancing. We did the merch. There was literally fully independent. I'm like, holy shit. That felt like the first real validation. You guys probably.
I felt validated every night.
Yeah, but you were a 21-year-old kid living every rock and roll cliche.
It's interesting to hear it from another perspective.
Yeah.
Because.
Okay, yeah. So you promote your own tour, it's successful.
Yeah. Then what? Then what is the whole. I start getting a reputation of being the guy. Have you met Jason? Oh, you haven't? He'll tell you Gloria Sons is going to be the biggest band in the world at some point.
He's delusional, too.
Yeah. Literally, that is the context around everything. And everybody told me, your band's not cool. They'll never break it alternative. And it would make me so angry that it became the North Star of everything.
Which upsets me because what is alternative music? I mean, the whole thing, it's like, we're a rock and roll band that plays our own instruments, yeah. But I don't think you can kind of pigeonhole us into anything. We've always had an extremely eclectic catalog.
Okay, let's kind of go fast and then get to that point. So now you're having success.
Yeah.
At what point do you hook up with Nick?
So, quick. So we go from that record to, I know if we make the Union 2.0, the band is never bigger than where we
are. And we didn't want to do that anyways.
So Brett and the guys tried to make a record two or three times, and I had this, I don't know if I've told them, so this is either going to make them angry or happy. I figured there's no ego in finding the right decision, and so if they are going to go out and try to make this record on their own, they're either going to deliver something that is stunning or they are going to be so frustrated in their pursuit that they're going to throw up the white flag and say, okay, so now what do we want to do? And I think we did that over about 6 months of them banging their head against the wall.
Three tries.
I was in LA meeting with a new gentleman at BMG, Jamie Neely, on the publishing side. And he's like, I got this. I'm like, I'm trying to make this record for this band, Glorious Sons. I can explain it to you, but I haven't heard what I need to hear. So he's like, let me play you this thing from this. He's like, I got this Danish producer, songwriter, and a couple guys that, and he played me one song. And I was like, they're making the record. And I called Ian. I'm like, I found it. Now, this is a band that the way they historically made a record to how that record is very different. And so I seeded the demo out to them individually. Hey, what do you think of this? Like, do you like the vibe of this? And everybody came back, oh, this is fucking great. Oh yeah, I would love to work with them. Not knowing what that meant, but I was just like, so come back 3 months later, I was like, guys, go to LA, sit with this team, give me a week, see what comes. We go out, first night in LA with the producers, the band drinks probably 4 pitchers of margaritas. Jay Emmons in Jay Emmons fashion looks across at the producer and says, so what's the fucking plan? What are we here for?
I remember it.
I swear to God. And I'm like, oh man.
These guys, like, all are kind of just like Frederick, Tom, Ryan, all kind of like looked like deer in the headlights.
Yeah.
It was so funny.
Yeah, everybody was so frustrated.
Well, we tried to make a record 3 times before we got here. So, like,
and did you know it wasn't working, or only Jason told you it wasn't
working? We all knew it wasn't working. Because it would take us, like, you know, 5 days to do 2 songs, and we'd come out of it and there just wasn't something. Like, we wanted to take a step. Like, that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to challenge ourselves creatively, change the game. But every time we went in, we kind of came out with the same material.
So we go to LA.
We knew what we wanted, but we didn't know what it looked like.
Yeah. Right. And you could see that. So I knew they wouldn't. The one thing with Brett when it comes to that sort of stuff, he's unwilling to compromise the pursuit of what's great. And so we do that night, and we end up at the Rainbow Room. And I knew we were going to be okay when Brett said to the producer, just, I'm not here to tell you what I want to do. You just, I'll give you a week, and you paint the picture with me on what we need to do.
We were there to get help.
Yeah.
Right.
We needed help more than at any point in our career. We needed help at that moment.
Yeah. And we made that record, which was the last record, which getting to how we met Nick.
15 days.
And the crazy part is,
you should have seen how confused we were going in there, though. I honestly didn't know if I'd ever be a musician again. And to come out after 15 days and have 10 songs, actually 13 songs that you loved, was like the greatest feeling of all time.
And it was loaded with hits. And I knew, I swear to God, and I knew in that moment that this, I was going to be able to convince people to support to get that number one at alternative radio. And we got it on the first single of that record. So fast forward, relationships with BMG. Ian and I come in, we operate BMG as the Canadian operation for a couple of years. Part of that, Dan Gill, Dan Cohen, who ran Vagrant, came up to meet us in the office, and we played them Josie off of the record. And they're like, we should sign this band. I was like, well, that was easy. This is wonderful. And in that interim, Dan Gill sends it to Nick Attaway. I have no idea who Nick Attaway is. From that day till almost till today, I get a Nick Attaway call at 8 o'clock in the morning. I don't know this guy. No deal memo, no nothing. He's calling me. He's like, we're going to do the deal, right? I'm like, I haven't even talked to a lawyer. He's like, I played it for this person. I played it for this person. Holy shit, this is the greatest record. I called Dan. I'm like, who's Nick?
Oh, my God.
Like, there was no formal introduction. That was how I met Nick Attaway. And he's like, this is it. This is going to be amazing. Holy shit. I can't believe you delivered. This is unbelievable. I love this band. Let's do it. So I was like, well, we're going to do it then. And the deal became secondary because at that point, I couldn't pull out of it would have been really bad. But that excitement is great. And that, I've learned, is more valuable than anything else. Everything's all right, goes to number one in Canada, and Nick goes to it with alternative radio. And we say the band's ability to say yes is why we're here today. They said yes to everything. We never looked at a budget. We never looked at the guarantee. It was yes. And we were all collectively digging ourselves into this enormous hole, but didn't give a shit. And so Nick's out there, and he's getting this thing. And we die on the vine 5 months into Everything's All Right, the first single on our BMG release. Dead. Done. Budget's gone.
But we like, Nick was out on the
road. Oh, that's what I mean.
Like,
yeah.
From the very first day.
Like, treating us.
Yeah. Like, Wait a minute.
Who is this guy?
I have to tell the story of when I met Nick.
Yeah.
So I don't know where we were in the States,
but we were in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. And this guy comes on the bus, and like, literally, like, it's like a freaking bull in a china shop. Just like, you might as well have kicked the door open. And he's coming in, and he's like, yeah, like, the set was great, but you should have played more new stuff. And then he starts, like, talking, and he's like, for, like, 3 hours that night, I heard, like, every conspiracy theory on the map. Like, everything that Nick is, he was in that first 3 hours of me meeting him.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring?
but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Okay, Nick, your story. You're from where?
Born and raised in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Okay, how do you ultimately get to BMG?
I was going to University of Pennsylvania. I wanted to be in the music industry. I was bartending.
Wait, you went to Penn, you say?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. I was bartending at three rock clubs, paying my way through school. I was interning at the radio station, interned for Epic Records, and interned for MCA. And I really wanted to get in the music business because in Philadelphia, there was no real radio station playing new music. And WMMR was the only station, but it was classic rock. So I would see all these amazing bands that I never heard of play in front of very small crowds and just become huge. And I wanted to be part of that.
And this is, how old are you and what year are we in?
I was 21 and it was 1991.
Okay.
And I graduated at the age of 26 in 96. I was on the six-year college plan because I wasn't smart enough to go to Penn. I kind of conned my way in. And so it took me a while. And then I went to, got my first job in LA doing college promotion at MCA, the National AAA, and West Coast Rock Alternative. Then I went to Arista. And then I went to go work for Corin Capshaw at Red Light Management. To head up promotion there in their early days, and then went to Vagrant, and then BMG bought Vagrant and became the head of promotion there. Now I oversee the Rock Alternative and AAA. So that's how I got to where I am on this. And, you know, when I first heard the music, my boss said, "You should hear this Glorious Sons. It's really good." And Dan, my boss, is very critical. He doesn't say things are very good very often. So I'm like, oh, shit. And then I heard it, and I'm like, oh, my God, every song is great. And to this day, I'll tell everyone, you know, they'll be like, what song should I hear? What's good? And I'm just like, pick any song. They're all great. There's not one bad song in any of their stuff. We took Everything Is All Right because we were thinking alternative, alternative, alternative. And we had, you know, we got like a bunch of really good stations. But, you know, it was over a six-month period, and I think we got into the 30s. You know, it didn't take off. Meanwhile, I was going to a lot of their shows. The first shows that I went to, they were opening up for Greta Van Fleet. And the one thing I noticed is that when they went on, if you just walked into the club and saw them on stage, you would have thought they were the headliner. Everyone that was there to see Greta. And when they saw the Glorious Sons, they freaked out. And I was like, that's another sign. Because having bartended in rock clubs for 6 years, you see how most opening bands get treated, you know, by the audience or the headliner, which is never usually that good. And I also noticed that the song Sawed Off Shotgun, SOS, was getting this like major reaction. And people were able to sing along to that song, even if they had never heard it before. And it was really connecting. And then we were having this talk about it being a radio single. And the biggest problem in America is, you know, lyrics. You got one lyric that could offend one person out of 1,000. It could just fuck you at radio. And I said, you know, guys, you know, we're a land of hypocrisy and school shootings and all this stuff. And even though the song doesn't advocate violence in any way, there could be issues. But then we realized that it was so good of a song that we should take that chance. And then right when we were thinking going to go for it, the Parkland shooting happened. And I said, we got to put the brakes on this and just, you know, wait it out. Because the one thing Americans do is they forget very quickly. So it's not off the table forever. It's just off the table until,
missing a real important part of this.
Oh, yeah.
He's not giving himself enough credit. The start of SOS at radio, there was no budget left. And he went on his own to find one champion at a time to bring back to the table, to go to the label, to open up budget. At this point, we are 9 months removed from the record coming out, 8 months probably, mm-hmm. in that window. no budget. No, nobody's reinvesting in a record 9 months. Like, it's just not happening. And while this story, well, this is happening, he's going out and championing. And on the back of the band playing all those radio shows, not getting the single, but all the promoters and all the shows were like, this is a real fucking rock and roll band. So they bought into the band, even though the song didn't get there. So we built up this goodwill. And Nick, I'm telling you, if he did not become proactive, and I don't know if it was from me screaming at him or collective love of the band, he went out and one at a time converted top-down radio folks on this band without asking for a dollar and going to the label to get money. And because I think that's a super important part of this.
Well, the thing is that, you know, you work at a record label and you see where a lot of money gets spent. And when you see, I think it's really important that you invest in potential. It's great when you sign a big band that has a big history. They may continue to have great success, but it's really important to invest in potential. And that's what these guys have. And they're one of my top five favorite bands of all time. My favorite band that I've ever worked in my career, doing radio promotion since 96. And I've worked with a lot of great bands and, you know, with a lot of great music. And, you know, and the record, you know, I wanted to make sure, I said, all right, we're going to take SOS to rock radio. Because, you know, alternative radio is having an identity crisis. And alternative radio more and more cares more about stream totals than music. And they're also thinking about crossing over to pop. Alternative radio used to be strictly about, you know, they were like the goth kids in school, and the goth kids would be goth kids. But now a lot of alternative programmers want that goth kid to be like a cheerleader, you know, or a football player, and they can't accept the fact that they are who they are. So alternative radio is having this identity crisis. All they want is streams. I said, at least rock radio, a lot of those guys, if they hear a hit, they'll still say, I'm going to play that. And so we got, and I said, but I'm not going to start with super small stations. I'm not going to be doing promotions, turn tricks. I want to get real stations and to lead the way, top down on a baby band. And we did that. And, you know, we were on the charts for like 40 some weeks. By the time we got to the first week of January of 2019, we went number one after like
16 weeks removed.
Yeah.
16 months removed from the record coming out.
Yeah. And it was like we were on the chart for like, I don't know, like 6 months. And then we go into January at number one. And then I found out that we were the most played song at Active Rock for 2019. On, you know, via media base. It was the number one rock record of 2019, which was amazing, you know, for an unsigned band. And that, you know, that really helped them. And the airplay really translated into streams, and we were able to see that go up and up and up. Then we tried to cross over to alternative, and we were picking up a lot of stations. Now, we were top 30 at alternative for 27 weeks, which was great. And we peaked at 23, and it was higher than Greta Van Fleet or, you know, Shinedown or Bad Flower, all these rock bands trying to cross over. And it was over a 6 month period. And we did get K Rock to add the record and KQX in Chicago. But right around that point, the stations at Alternative that had played it 1,000 times were like, it was a huge hit for us. It was great, but we got it.
We're done.
And then as soon as you lose your bullet, people are like, oh, well, I guess it's done.
Right.
You know?
Okay, let's go to today. So where is the band from your perspective today, Nick?
Well, you know, the one thing that I always say is that this is a career band. And I always tell, you know, bands, I said, look, you know, having that hit single, that hit record at radio, you know, that's winning the lottery. That's a shot in the arm. That's the nitrous in the gas tank. You know, but at the end of the day, every spin, every ad at a radio station should be looked upon as like, oh, God, you know, it's not about getting that hit. It's about moving the ball forward. It's about being able to sell those extra tickets. It's about turning on an extra fan. You know, this is a band that, you know, when you see one hit wonders, you know, the label like owns that band, you know, because they've got nothing else. You know, this is a band that has, unlike most Canadian bands, have put in the blood, sweat, and tears to break in the U.S. People say rock bands from Canada can't break here. Well, that's because if they're huge in Canada, a lot of times they don't want to spend all that money and time, you know, starting over from scratch. But these guys do. And they're the biggest rock band in Canada, playing huge arenas, what, 15,000 in Toronto. But they will always, they'll be on the road. They will always have an audience. It'll keep growing. Their fans are insane. In such a great way, and they really truly connect emotionally. And that's the thing. A hit is a big hook, but it has to emotionally connect.
And the lyrics. We see that connection on the live level. And I think Ian and I, we are at the band's first. We put up our first arena show in Toronto a year and a half ago, and the whispers were, they are fucking crazy. No way. Like, I mean, like, this isn't, like, we were getting laughed at all. Like, this, you don't go from doing a couple club dates at the beginning of the record cycle to this at the end of the record cycle.
We actually got told, I want to say this, by another band, by a member of another band, we were talking about the arena show, and he said, you skipped a step, eh?
yeah. And so we go out, and remember, no press at this point. We are not a darling of anybody. And we go out and we do the show, and it's magical. And the manager, the last manager of the Hip, guy from Kingston, Bernie Breen, was there.
I know Bernie.
So Bernie takes Ian and I side stage at that show. And the one thing about that show that validated everything we've believed into this day is from song one to song 28 or whatever we played that night, people sung every word. I don't mean the radio records. Mm-hmm. I mean songs that we've never released all the way through. And Bernie took Ian and I aside and put his arm around us. And he's like, just stop for a second. He's like, I've seen this once before. And he's just like, be present, enjoy. But as much as that was a victory, one of the reviews of that night was the first half of the write-up was, I didn't want to be here. And I didn't believe that they could do, like, that was the narrative.
That's what every review we get is, I don't want them to do well.
Yeah, that was, and we'd sold out this arena.
It pisses me off so fucking much. And if it's not that, it's like they catch us on our worst show of all time, and they just slander the shit out of us.
Okay, let's forget the reviews for 1 second. Okay,
I read the reviews.
That's a whole rabbit hole I'd rather not go down right this very second. Many people will say rock is dead. If you look at the Spotify top 50, there's not one rock track. So what is the future of this band? Because it's a rock band. What is the future of rock in the world at large?
Rock is not dead. You're using the wrong metric.
What metric should we use?
I mean, you should just go to, you know.
Go to a show.
Go to any, you know, club down the street. There's going to be kids playing their guitar, screaming their head off.
So why do you think it's not translating into streams? I mean, you have a good number of streams, double-digit millions, but compare it to, you know, the...
It's simple. It's absolutely... I study this stuff. And it is because rock as an early adopter to technology is not always great. And not only that, it's a specific, singular purchase connection. It's not a passive listening environment in that same manner. So if you look at iTunes, and Apple's having a tough time doing it, is building their rock streaming, because iTunes is a very deliberate purchase. Sorry, iTunes is a very deliberate purchase where you've got streaming as a passive audience. I think you are looking at passive stream numbers across all the other genres that have a bit of a baked-in number just based on what it is. I do not think rock has fully converted as a genre to the streaming platforms. Country just came on, and look at the last 2 years of country, massive. And they are late adopters.
But does that mean that you should create passive listening music?
No. No, what I'm saying is the last round of adopters, so when always rhythmic urban music, early adopters, technology, history of time. Rock, the last one to move. Country, as an indicator of that growth, is massive. So I believe rock right now would be like buying property in Manhattan in the 30s.
Okay, Nick, what do you think?
I think that there's a lot of you know, when you when I talk about alternative and they were like talking to go to pop and the streams, you know, there's a lot of people that listen to rock absorb it differently. A lot of the pop stuff is listened to by 13-year-old girls. They'll listen to it over and over and over and over again, constantly, telling all their friends to listen to it over and over and over and over again. And that looks great when you're looking at a computer screen and see all those streams, but you don't necessarily see who's all behind it. And you also got to realize that more other people are being catered to other than 13-year-old girls. 13-year-old girls may drive the industry overall.
13-year-old girls.
You know, I'm sorry, man. But you know what I mean. And I think people that listen to... yeah, that did come out bad.
See, not for me.
Okay.
Their minds were in the gutter.
But then when people listen to rock music, you know, they want to hear a whole album. They have their own collection. They could be a huge fan of a band, but they're not going to listen to that one song over and over again. And they may listen to multiple albums, or they may also, and they also have a large collection of, you know, records that they'll go to, right? So it's just a different habit of listening, but they're also more in tune of being loyal and staying there for the long career. So if you're a fan of a rock band and, you know, I will always love the Glorious Sons. I will always go to the shows, even if I wasn't working them. And the same thing with other rock bands that I love, right? So it's like really the long-term, what I'm going to give long-term. You know, you see those teenage girls that I was talking about. In 2 years, that band that they think is the greatest thing in the world right now, they're going to completely forget about and not even like in a couple of years.
That's what I was saying, but you're using the wrong metric of rock is dead. Because... you're based on front-facing streaming numbers. You're not based. There are, I could find 10,000 artists that have more streams than this band that cannot play to 10 people in their city. It's what you use to quantify what is alive and what is dead. And when you are in a room of people that are all on the same page singing the same song, that's alive and well. Try to get 5 people to order the same toppings on one pizza. At a venue, in that moment, that singular moment, that speaks to how alive it is. We got to stop putting that narrative of the consumption is tied to what something's alive or thriving. Because would you rather be an artist that has 80 million streams that will never be able to play a show and never be, and you're at the mercy of, is that going to continue? Am I going to have another hit? Or is healthy and vibrant to you being able to play to anywhere from 1,000 on a low to 12,000 or 15,000.
Okay, let's go back. I was at the venue and I noticed a Winnebago and a U-Haul. I presume that's your traveling apparatus.
Not anymore, thank God.
But actually, that just changed today?
Yeah, no, that's that we used to travel in that, but we actually travel in a bus now.
Travel in a bus. Okay, so what's the being on the road? Is that good, bad, or otherwise?
It just depends on the day, really. I mean, for myself, I really enjoy playing music and being on the road and kind of like that camaraderie that you have with you know, your best friends in a bus. And but I mean, if I have a bad show, I hate being on the road.
Okay, how about, you know, people say, well, you know, the 22 hours on the road, the only reason it works is the 1 or 2 hours on stage. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, and the other thing, if we go back to rock and roll, the rock and roll acts of the classic rock era, they went on the road and let's say they misbehaved in hotel rooms.
Yeah.
And they partook of certain opportunities. To what degree do you do that? To what degree was that inhibited by mobile phone cameras?
Well, we don't have the money to trash hotel rooms yet, so that's not been a thing. But we have fun. We just go out and have fun. Honestly, like right from the first day we ever hit the road, I treated it like this is never going to happen again. So let's enjoy it while we're here. I mean, now it's more of a career, and you have to be sensible, and you can't go gangbusters every night, but we have fun.
Okay, well, let's go. You know, you mentioned Rush earlier. Those are nice guys. You know, obviously Neil Peart has passed away, and they probably won't play under the same name or whatever, maybe ever again. But I've been to Rush shows, and you can count the number of women there on a couple of hands. So I went to your show last night. 40 or 50% of the audience is women.
Yeah.
That's you have any idea why that's the case?
That's very new. I mean,
well, it is
new. We were probably lucky last night, realistically.
No, I don't think so. It's my songs.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm a sensitive man, and I mean, I think that's what.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, and you can answer any way would you like. Is there still a groupie scene in the rock and roll world?
No, I don't think so. I mean, not that I know.
Just like it could be dudes too. Like we see people pop up in every city. It's like it's not groupies. It's like people who love your music who end up hanging out with you. It's like, I mean,
it's like the Deadhead vibe.
Okay, yeah. I was just gonna say. Yeah. So, Brett, having seen you and not having seen you before, you're quite the dynamic front man.
Yeah.
And certainly, even if the audience isn't reacting, you'll energize them. Where does that come from?
I don't know. I'm crazy, man. When I was younger, I was the entertainer and the joker and, you know, the crybaby and then, you know, I don't want to say the talented one, but the, you know, the
okay, but the difference is most people save the sing-along to the end of the set.
Yeah.
Where you essentially started off with that. That's a big risk. People may not sing.
Yeah. Well, we try to take risks every night, but I mean, I know people are going to sing. I just, in my heart of hearts, I feel like that's
okay. But you're up on stage. You're moving. You're not staying in one place. You're exhorting, imploring the audience. That just feels totally natural to you.
I mean, it hurts sometimes, and you lose your wind. But I mean, I never knew that there was another way to do it.
Well, do you ever? I mean, every night, do you hit the stage saying, "I'm going to win the audience over"?
Yes. Yes, okay. 100%. And I haven't before.
That's my question.
And I've also crumbled on stage before.
But there are some nights, no matter what you try, it doesn't work.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, so what's the next step? Obviously, you sell arenas in Canada, okay? And this is probably more of a question for Jason and Nick. How do you make it bigger, which is always a desire?
Well,
and you want to push the button. Okay, Bray, you can answer.
Yeah, sure. I think that, I mean, we've been pounding the pavement for like, I don't know, like 7 years?
Yeah.
I mean, there hasn't been a year that we haven't played over 60% shows, like, or been on the road for 60%
of the year,
like in like 3 or 4 years. So I truly believe at some point it's time to kind of take a step back and relax. You know, you don't want to rest on your laurels. You want to still be working. But I don't think that you can go forever like that. It's going to turn very badly. It won't go on that way.
Okay, but let's just assume this is as big as you ever get. Are you happy with that?
I think that's kind of a state of mind that I've been kind of dealing with and trying to figure out as a person, you know, not as a, you know, rock entertainer. For myself, I want to have 7 billion people hear the songs we write. That is
right.
That's what we're doing out here. And we're always going to be, you know, guys with good work ethic. And I mean, maybe those opportunities don't come, you know. I think there's a lot of luck in this business, not to downplay anybody's work ethic or what they've done here, but there's a lot of luck that goes into this whole business as well. And I mean, it's very hard work, but some bands are great and they never even get a shot. They never get out of their hometown. And I mean, we are playing in front of 15,000 people. I mean, that's insane, you know. Guys who didn't know what a producer is, who didn't have guitar pedals, who never owned a guitar pedal for the first 3 years of our career, are playing in front of 15,000 people. I mean, just...
That is incredible.
Isn't that enough? Isn't that enough?
Well, like, only you can answer, but there's certain inherent limits that other people have hit. Tragically hit.
Yeah.
Biggest band in Canada, never really made it in the USA. Yeah. A lot of acts you talk on the rock charts, you mention the Trues, et cetera, they are not big in America.
Yeah.
So in addition to playing rock and roll, which is the hardest and the lengthiest time, so do you feel that, hey, you know, it's more difficult to make it outside of your home country?
Well, I think that there's so many more people in this country and so many more bands. And I don't...
It's like, just a different scale, really.
And like Nick has described, we're a career band. Like, this isn't about racing to the top right now, and not in my eyes. I think you have to hit the road and play it smart and have fun and get better at your job and, you know, learn and write great songs and, you know, feed a sense of community into people and truly love what you do. And I think if you can do all those things, I think that you can, you know, you can create magic, like real magic. And I would love to do that forever. I just don't want to do it all at once.
Well, how many shows a year are they playing?
At least, I think the 5-year count was just under 800 shows.
Okay, that's a lot of shows. So, Nick, mm-hmm. how important is radio today in breaking a band, certainly a rock band?
Well, it's, you know, everyone likes to trash radio, you know, and they like to say it's all about the internet, but radio is still really important. When managers sign a band or a record label, it's always about sync, international, radio. Those are the three things that everybody wants. And anyone will tell you that when you get a lot of airplay, you sell a lot more tickets. You know, you'll get more streams, you know. And I love seeing the magic. I've been doing radio promotion, like I said, for over 20 years. And to me, it's magic, you know, to witness Brett create magic and something out of nothing. And then I get to be a soldier and go out there and get people to hear it and turn people onto it and then travel to that city and see people reacting to that song and singing along and going crazy and screaming. When they hear the song that they heard on the radio, people are still listening to the radio. And also, you know, when you talked at one point, you talked about filters, right? There's a lack of filters. Yes, there's playlists, but they're limited. And, you know, a lot of radio stations still play a part in being a filter of new music because people don't have the time to sit in front of the internet and try to find the stuff that they like. So whether it's rock or alternative or, you know, AAA or non-com radio, there is still that discovery. And a lot of times what you see is the most consumed online and the most talked about on socials is what's getting the most played, you know, at radio. When we were in Philly, the last time they were in Philly, they sold out like a 200 cap room. And then when we go back to Philly and it was over 800 tickets sold
a year later.
And I'm seeing WMMR t-shirts on like all over the place. And that's the radio station that has adopted this band and has really loved this band and has them live on air on their morning show to perform and interview. And today, most radio stations, they won't put a band on the morning show for an interview and performance. They'll put them in a side room and videotape it for YouTube and sell it to an advertiser. Not that it's a bad thing and it doesn't give me the awareness, but you know, on MMR, I'll have 50,000 people in a top 5 market hearing them talk and then find out that there was over 100 tickets sold, you know, online day of show because of that. So that's what drives me to do this.
You know? Okay, so we've really gotten the groundwork here. What is the next step and how big can the Gloria Sons become and what is your goal?
We are a record cycle and a half behind where we are in Canada. We are seeing the exact same metrics, the same litmus test of how it's growing. We're seeing the same growth, almost to a chart if you put it behind it. I think all the things that Brett is saying, the things that you can control and the love of it, and that will lead to the next success because we've already proven this concept. And we didn't prove it on the back of these elements that we don't control. We proved it based on what works for this band and what we want to do. And now we've applied it into the arguably, easily the largest music market on the planet. And we are going from 200 to 800. We're going from 300 to 900. Like, we're seeing it. Detroit, we're going from 300 to 2,200.
Well, Nick did a great sales pitch on radio. In terms of selling those overall tickets, are they all sold by radio, or what do you think is driving that consumption?
I think it's this fan base. I think we have this rabid community of people. I met a couple in Seattle last year that had been to 4 shows. They were 19 years old, and they met us after the show in Seattle, and they've been to 4 shows. Portland, Seattle. I can't remember the other ones. The fan community and the people being the start of the megaphone that believe that everything this band does comes from a place of true heart and integrity are preaching that to everybody.
I think definitely that, like, We might not have the most fans, but our fans probably annoy the hell out of people with how much.
Well, yeah, how'd you end up opening for the Stones?
Well, we were actually talking about this in an argument, well, in a heated discussion about production cost. We Mark Norman signed the band to AEG on a global touring deal, and he's like, maybe one day we could play, you guys could play with the Stones. And obviously, we're all huge Stone fans. And so I'm having this conversation. This is our first club tour in Canada, and I'm putting the pitch in, and Mark, it goes to the Stones team, and it goes from, I think it goes like Ronnie, Charlie, Keith, Nick, Mick. It goes like, that's how it goes. And it got somewhere in the middle, and then they're like, well, I don't know if they can handle a big stage, because we hadn't played an arena yet. We were a club act from Canada. But they're like, oh, we like it. So we play our first hometown show, arena show in Kingston, 4,500 people. Spend a lot of money on production. I was a bit of a punching bag taking for that. Filmed it, put an edit together, sent it to AG, who sent it through to the Stones. And I was on a beach in Miami with my wife, and I got a phone call saying, do you want to go to Marseille and open for the Stones? And the first call I made was to you. And I think it's like,
that's probably the only time I've been excited in the last 10 years.
It was unbelievable. So we had to move mountains, cost us a bunch of money to go do it. We do that show. And then we got to do it again this summer in Toronto. And it came from the way Nick believes in the band, the way I believe in the band, the way the fans believe in the band. Mark Norman believed in the band and advocated in places that we would never be able to touch. And so when Brett says we may not have the most fans, we for sure have real special ones that feel like kinship to this. And that is going to be the key to how we become a household name.
And it reverberates all around too. Like, I don't think there's a single passive person working for us, like on any step. Like, everybody with us wants the same thing. And I mean, Jason calls it world domination, but I mean, we just want people to hear this and to take the ride with us. And
I think on that note, we've covered the story of the Glorious Sons to date. One thing I will say is, you know, you are an amazing frontman, Brett, and the band is very dynamic live, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass.
Thank you.
So therefore, in terms of going to see, as they say, you had a very engaged audience when I saw you at the El Rey. In any event, gentlemen, thanks for doing this. Till next time, this is Bob Lefson.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.